As Ukraine prepares to take a big step toward joining the European Union, a U.S. ambassador returns to Kyiv and shares with us her top priority.
We have been totally focused on getting Ukraine the items that of security items and the weapons that they need as soon as possible. And this is actually my number one focus in coming here.
We also hear from another U.S. ambassador about his experience of working in the Russian capital under heavy U.S. sanctions.
The economic relationship between the United States and Russia has been crushed, has been ground to dust, and it is not coming back anytime soon.
And later in the program, a U.S.-based aid group tells us how they have been helping Ukraine's internally displaced to obtain life's basic necessities. Today is Wednesday, June 22nd. This is Flashpoint Ukraine from the Voice of America. Good evening, I'm Michael Lippin. Local officials in Ukraine say Russia carried out deadly missile strikes on the country's northeastern city of Kharkiv and southern city of Mykolaiv on Tuesday and Wednesday, as invading Russian forces pressed on with their offensive in Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. In a sign of diplomatic support for Kyiv, European Union leaders were preparing to hold a summit on Thursday and Friday with a top agenda item, approving Ukraine's bid to be a candidate for the bloc. Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from Paris.
Hours before the European Union summit, France, which currently holds the presidency of the Council of the EU, offered a confident assessment of Kyiv's candidacy application.
La semaine dernière, et nous avons une discussion aujourd'hui qui a permis de montrer.
France's Europe Minister Clément Beaune said there is total consensus in favor following discussions among EU country representatives. Now, he says, it's up to their leaders to formally vote on Ukraine's candidate status Thursday, along with those of Moldova and Georgia. Kyiv has been pushing hard to join the 27-member bloc as soon as possible. Some EU countries, like Portugal and Denmark, earlier expressed reservations. But last week, European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen offered a strong endorsement.
Ukrainians are ready to die for the European perspective. We want them to live with us, the European dream.
But it seems unlikely EU leaders will agree to Ukraine's call for fast-tracking its application. Being admitted into the bloc can take years or decades.
I mean, I think if there were a fast track, then it would provoke some uproar from the Western Balkan countries, from a number of countries who've been in the anti-chamber of this candidate status for a while now.
Tara Varma heads the Paris office of the European Council on Foreign Relations Policy Institute.
I think the Europeans need to be quite careful about how they deal with this. Honestly, already granting candidate status in such a short period would be quite a revolution.
France is pushing for an intermediary association for Ukraine and other non-EU members in the meantime.
So with your permission, can I invite you to this place?
This week's summit follows a visit to Ukraine by leaders of France, Germany, and Italy, the EU's three most powerful members, along with Romania. Beyond the symbolism, they promise to deliver more weapons, a source of tension with Ukraine, among other issues. But while EU leaders have displayed remarkable unity in agreeing to ever stronger sanctions against Russia over the war, European citizens are feeling its economic backlash. The European Council on Foreign Relations, Tara Varma.
Europeans will also have to think about how they deal with the situation at home as well, because we're seeing an increasing sense of worry from the European population side and, of course, the beginning of a war fatigue.
Also up for discussion this summit will be the bloc's deteriorating relationship with Moscow. Over the past week, Russia has cut off natural gas exports to more EU countries, notably heavyweights France and Germany. It's also threatened EU and NATO member Lithuania over its rail transit blockade of some goods to the Russian enclave of Kaliningrad. Meanwhile, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell has called Russia's own blockade of Ukraine's grain exports, which are critical for some of the world's poorest countries, a war crime. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
It's been only a few weeks since the U.S. put an ambassador back in Ukraine after withdrawing all diplomats from the country in February ahead of Russia's full-scale invasion. Ambassador Bridget Brink, whom the U.S. Senate confirmed to her position in May, sat down last week with VOA Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gongadze in Kyiv and shared her thoughts about renewing the U.S. diplomatic presence there.
I can't tell you how proud I am to be here and to be back as a U.S. ambassador and to be working with a fantastic team of Americans and Ukrainian staff. So the challenges in front of Ukraine and us are enormous. When I came, I set out five goals, immediate goals that we had. And the first is to help Ukraine defend itself. The second is to help ensure accountability and justice for war crimes and atrocities. The third is to help ensure that humanitarian assistance, especially U.S. Funded assistance, gets to targeted recipients, especially in conflict zones. The fourth is to oversee this massive amount of U.S. assistance and to provide the appropriate oversight from here at post in Kyiv. And the last and the most fun is to bring our team back together, the Americans and the Ukrainians that make up the embassy, and to rebuild our platform. So yes, the challenges in front of Ukraine are very big and in front of all of us, but we are really determined and ready to meet them.
President Biden yesterday announced additional funding for Ukraine. The United States have been the biggest supporter of Ukraine militarily and financially. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned about overseeing how this money is used in this country. What kind of system do you have right now to oversee the money?
So there are long established systems for all of the assistance that we give, including security assistance. And what we're doing now is just making sure that we are playing the appropriate role we need to play here in Kyiv, but working with the Ministry of Defense and other parts of the Ukrainian government. So it's important for that we're here for that and other reasons, but I'm confident that we will be able to do this.
Is there any special envoy to oversee the support that the United States is giving to Ukraine?
The way we are doing it is that we'll have our embassy, and so I'm really happy to be here as the ambassador, and then I will have specific staff, and including senior staff, that are dedicated to these goals and more.
President Zelensky kind of hinted that a few days ago that the United States is not giving enough or giving too late. How would you comment his position?
Well, I would say that since the beginning of the war and even before, we have been totally focused on getting Ukraine the items that of security items and the weapons that they need as soon as possible. And this is actually my number one focus in coming here. I do think that there were some problems early on, and I'm just here to make sure that everything that we are doing is directly supporting Ukrainians on the front lines and also helping Ukraine improve its battlefield position, which we also believe will help its negotiating position at a time when that is appropriate.
How is your relationship with the Ukrainian government right now? Do you work on all the levels of Ukrainian government? I understand that it's a time of war still.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I've noticed more than anything, having been a diplomat for 25 years, is the overwhelming and positive support that I have received from the government, from people outside of government, from the population, and also the support from back home, including the public in my part of the Midwest. So I'm really grateful for that. I think it's really important for us. I think we understand, I understand this is incredibly important for Ukraine and Ukraine's future and existence. But I believe it's also incredibly important to European security and to the United States that we do not allow borders to be changed by force.
That was U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Bridget Brink speaking to my colleague Miroslava Gongadze. Another U.S. diplomat with a keen interest in the war is Ambassador to Russia John Sullivan, who is visiting Washington on Tuesday for a gathering of U.S. chiefs of mission from around the world. VOA Russian service reporter Rafael Sakov met with Sullivan at the State Department and asked him how his work in Moscow has been affected by U.S. sanctions imposed on Russia since it escalated its war against Ukraine in February.
So one big change is a lot of the work I did from the first
2+ years I was there as ambassador was on behalf of U.S. companies doing business in Russia. Until the end of last year, we had over 1,150 U.S. companies doing business in Russia. Now we have a tiny fraction of that number. I met, for over 2 years, I met every 2 weeks, virtually because of the pandemic, with the American Chamber of Commerce in Russia, based in Moscow. Now, there are very few members of the chamber left. The economic relationship between the United States and Russia has been crushed, has been ground to dust, and it is not coming back anytime soon. So that's been it's not only had a major effect on the economy of Russia, but it's had a major effect on my work, because a lot of what I was doing before was engaging you with U.S. companies that were looking to invest or had problems with the Russian government, this regulation, that administrative proceeding. And now all I hear from them are about their plans to depart.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you about the colleagues from your colleague, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Bridget Brink. She said in an interview with VOA in Kyiv that, quote, "We all understand very much what's at stake, and that's why we are here to help Ukraine prevail." So how confident are you that Ukraine will be successful, overall success, after this already 4 months of the full-scale Russian war and advances which Russia does in eastern Ukraine?
Yeah, well, I'm not a military expert. But just as I say this, just as a human being, what President Zelensky and his government has done to resist this massive aggression is inspirational. The way I don't think the Russian government expected the Ukrainian government to stand firm and resist. For President Zelensky to stay in Kyiv with the Russian army headed south out of Belarus to get him, that took nerve, that took courage. It was inspirational. It motivated, I'm sure, his fellow Ukrainians who believe in their country, are fighting for their country, and they're not going to give up. You know, the Russian government, Russian media types like to talk about the strength of Russia. They've underestimated the strength of Ukraine.
And Vladimir Zelensky repeatedly said that he is ready for talks with Vladimir Putin, while the peace negotiations between Ukraine and Russia have now stagnated, and even Ukrainian chief negotiator David Arakhamia, who was here in Washington last week, he said that probably the talks could resume by the end of August or somewhere at the end of August. What do you think should happen for Putin to approve this meeting, or at least a call with Zelensky?
Well, it's something that President Biden, leaders across the world have been urging the Russian government, A, to stop the war, to stop the aggression, and negotiate. I've seen no indication that the Russian government, that President Putin, is interested in negotiating. They want the Ukrainians to give up, resistance, succumb to a Russian invasion, and then they'll negotiate. And President Zelensky said on behalf of his people, whom he represents, democratically elected president, said, no thanks. We'll negotiate, but not when you're holding a gun to our head. So negotiations, ultimately, I think President Biden would say this conflict will end, as all conflicts do, with some form of negotiation. And what the United States is looking to do is to support Ukraine, to support President Zelensky, so that the outcome that the Ukrainians want themselves is what's achieved not only in the battlefield, but in negotiations eventually with Russia.
Do you think that China would have played much bigger role in urging Russia to negotiate? And maybe you had some talks with the Chinese ambassador in Moscow, or if you are not in discussions?
I have not. I know the U.S. government has. My colleagues in the U.S. government have. And made it clear that our hope and expectation is that China stands with the rest of the civilized world, those who support the UN Charter, those who are against aggressive war and violence. And I think it's fair to say there's disappointment that the rhetoric from Beijing hasn't been what one would have hoped. But I also don't know that we've seen the type of material support that would actually bolster the physical effort by the Russian government to crush Ukraine.
This can be a historic week for Ukraine, as they can become and be granted the EU candidate status at the European Council meeting. And President Zelensky said recently that Russian attacks will intensify, and he expects greater hostile activity during this week. So President Biden said on Monday that Ukraine is very likely to join the European Union. How important would the candidate status be now in this particular situation right now for Ukraine, taking into account possible Russia's reaction?
Well, we've all heard, and you just cited President Zelensky's most recent statement, how much the Ukrainians want to be part of the EU and NATO, for that matter. And the United States government, President Biden has said this, Secretary Blinken has said, we support the aspirations of the Ukrainian government that look to associate with the EU. It's tragic that their neighbors to the east, people with whom most Ukrainians, as you know, Raphael, share a common language. President Zelensky is a fluent Russian speaker. It's tragic that Russia has driven away what should be a country that's close to Russia. But we support the Ukrainian aspirations to join Ukraine, and it's tragic that Russia is pushing, at the point of a gun, Ukraine closer to the West.
You were listening there to U.S. Ambassador to Russia John Sullivan in conversation with VOA Russian's Rafael Sakov. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Michael Lippin. In the final part of their recent conversation, Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller spoke to the Chief Humanitarian Officer for Chorus International, Tamara Demuria, about what kind of aid her U.S.-based organization is providing to Ukrainians who are unable to flee the country.
We are providing both the hygiene items and sanitary items to maintain sanitary conditions, but we also provide temporary stays in some of these organized centers that are willing and able to house displaced population. We're also providing things such as roving medical services, which basically means clinic on the wheels, where you have a team of doctors hopping in the car and driving around, bringing the medical screening and diagnostics closer to the internally displaced in order for them not to wait in long queues and miss some of the basic diagnostics opportunities or even medical care. These are the things that are still in huge demand. I think the reason population is very worried that they have nowhere to go, they're realizing that their time is ticking and the clock is ticking. They can't stay with their friends and family for long. They have to have a solution for some sort of a medium to long-term housing, which is still under a big question mark. What I'm hearing constantly as I meet with these populations, and particularly women, which comprise the majority of the displaced because their husbands are not necessarily allowed to leave their cities, villages, because of the conscription that is a mandatory thing, and they can be called on anytime. They're saying if we had a place to work and at least sustain our livelihoods by earning a little bit, we would not feel that we depend on somebody else to give us a hand. And that is a very powerful thing, because their dignity is so impacted, and they're so willing to be helpful and not become a burden for those hosting them in other parts of the country. It's a big challenge for the international society to understand what could be those interim solutions to provide income generating activities for the displaced, so that they can start looking at more autonomous ability to sustain their longer-term living in whatever conditions they define it to be.
Tamara, I wanted to ask you about those who are working in Ukraine's agricultural fields, because as we have discussed many times on this program, Ukraine is a major state in the world that provides wheat and other grains for a number of other countries. And the UN and other analysts have said that because of the disruption, there could be significant food insecurity moving forward. So what did you see on your travels throughout Ukraine as it pertains to those who are working in the fields.
Needless to say that agriculture and seasonal and the impact on the season will definitely be something that will overall reflect on the market and availability of certain food and commodities, staple food and commodities. So far, they get away with it. And again, it's summer season, so they manage to harvest fruits and some vegetables. Here comes the fall, and it will definitely be a different situation. Ourselves on the Polish side, and we're considering to do the same in Ukraine, as well as many other organizations are trying to provide cash assistance. It is a number one need, as described by the population, because with cash, they have flexibility of basically attending to their needs rather than some organizations prescribing what they are entitled to or what they would love to have. I think it's a very fair request, and particularly in the western part of the country where markets are still functional and have not been disrupted, the population definitely can purchase at least the bare minimum that they require for their families. As we get closer to the winter, I think the situation will become a little harder, and it will require a lot of thinking, collective thinking, not just across the international society, but also together with the government to find medium to long-term solutions. I think one big difference when you look at Ukraine crisis compared to other parts of the world where most of us are responding is that $1 may subsidize the living or support number of people in some other parts of the world. Here, $1 only scratches the surface of the needs.
You can find the earlier parts of Steve's conversation with Tamara Demuria in the Monday and Tuesday editions of Flashpoint Ukraine. U.S. facial recognition technology is starting to play a role in Ukraine's resistance against the Russian invasion. VOA's Julie Tabo explains.
Though controversial, U.S. police are increasingly relying on facial recognition software to identify suspects and victims. Now the technology is being used in war to identify the dead, potential enemies, and suspects of war crimes. Leonid Timchenko is head of the Department of Information and Analytical Support of the National Police of Ukraine. He spoke with VOA via Skype.
Facial recognition, it's one of the very, very useful tools which we use right now, and it works perfect. Inside the National Police of Ukraine, we have more than five departments who use it.
Clearview AI, a U.S. facial recognition software firm, has given Ukrainian officials use of its database containing billions of faces to check the identities of Russian soldiers. The company collects images from sites like Facebook and other public websites, including from Russian social media sites such as VKontakte, or VK. Juan Tontet is co-founder and CEO of Clearview AI. He spoke with VOA via Skype.
They had photos of two deceased soldiers. One of them had identification on them, and the other one did not. And so just from the photo of the face, they're able to run it through the system, and they would have been able to identify the online social media profile of the person who's now deceased.
Tontat says that if people know their identity will eventually be determined from a photo snapped by a phone, the technology may act as a deterrent to war crimes. But Clearview is controversial in the U.S. because of how it obtains photos and how its software has been used. Technology researcher Stephanie Hare is the author of a new book, Technology is Not Neutral. She spoke with VOA via Skype.
That Clearview AI's business model is taking your face data that you've put up maybe on an online photo album or on your social media accounts for a very different purpose and turned it into a weapon that's now being used in a theater of war.
Critics of Clearview advocate for stronger regulations of the technology. But for those grappling with wartime atrocities, facial recognition software is a tool to keep. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
That's all for today's program. You can find more of VOA's coverage of Ukraine and other global news around the clock on our website, voanews.com. Thank you for listening. I'm VOA's Michael Lippin. Good night from Washington.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.